No, not a political podcast, but here's 10 minutes of Dave and I ranting. Actually, there's no 10 minutes of Dave and I ranting because we binned it.
Welcome to GCP Bytes, episode number 5 for Friday, the 8th of November, 2024. GCP Bytes is a podcast where we discuss Google Cloud and tech. And I'm your host, Stephen Bancroft. On today's show, Google outpaces its competitors. The DORA report is out. What does it say? Elon Musk is up to more shenanigans. Plus, is AI going to take control of your browser? We find out in the AI wars. But before we get to any of that, I'd like to introduce the co-host of the show, Dave Wall. How are you, Dave?
Yeah, I'm doing all right, bud. How are you?
Awesome, mate. Awesome. And our very own GDE, Ian Brown. How are you, mate?
Good, mate. How are you guys doing?
Very good. Very good. What have you been up to in the fortnight?
Lots of electronic stuff on a breadboard at the moment. I'm building a little annealer for home here, and doing it all on a Raspberry Pi Pico with a whole heap of extraneous hardware that hangs off it.
Uh-huh. What does this annealer do?
So an annealer is for when you're reloading ammunition for shooting. As you reload over and over again, the necks on a case get really hard and brittle. So an annealer heats them up to the point of where they're almost flexible and realigns all the structures inside the brass. So it's nice and soft again.
Mm. This is so you can reuse the shells.
That's
right?
Because they're expensive.
Yeah, okay.
Lots expensive.
Mm. taking brass off the range.
No.
Checking your boots for spoilage, huh?
I definitely always take the brass off the range because the 65284 Lapua cases that I'm using are expensive. For 100 cases, I think it's about $270.
Wow.
Yeah. That's what I was going to ask. What caliber are they?
Yeah, so it's 7mm Shaheen. Okay. That's a Wildcat round.
Mm-hmm. Wow, yeah, that's not cheap.
No.
Actually, there was a meme I saw, I think, kicking around on Facebook, and it shows, like, you know, a cruise missile launching from a ship or, you know, a Gatling gun firing, and as it fires, there's a dollar counter in the bottom.
Dollar counter's going, yeah. I've seen the same thing with the A-10 Warthog, because it fires I think it's a 30mm. It's a 30mm Gatling gun that sits on the front of the Warthog.
Yeah, the Gow Avenger.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. And, each one of those rounds is like $12 or something like that. I can't remember the exact cost of it, but, yeah, it's firing.
It's like 10,000 of them.
It's firing like 6,000 rounds a minute or something.
There's so much kickback off it that it can only fire in short bursts, otherwise it stalls the plane.
Because they fly pretty slow as it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
4,200 rounds a minute it is. Yeah, it does 4,200 rounds a minute.
Yeah, wow. Well, I haven't been up to much personally. Pretty busy with other things around here. I have a Commodore 64 sitting in the garage with one of the I've taken three of the RAM chips out. I've put two of them in sockets and put them back in, but I ran out of sockets, so it's sitting on my workbench, missing a RAM chip at the moment. I've got the chip, but I've got to get over to JCar and get some sockets for it. So, I'm hoping. I definitely know those three RAM chips are faulty. I'm suspecting another one's faulty, but I really don't know at the moment.
Do you reckon you might get it live for us by next podcast? Yeah, 2 weeks.
I'm not making any promises at the moment.
So. Oh, come on, we want to see it in all its glory.
It'll be good. Plus, we are getting some work done here with the builders at the moment, and the spot where I want to put the table and have it all set up is right in the corner where there's no gyprock on the wall. So I don't want to put anything there until
I get full of dust and gross. Yeah. And
exactly.
Right.
You're getting the when you get the sockets, are you going to get the ones with little round holes in them?
The one with little round holes.
Yeah,
in them.
Yeah. So there's three different types of sockets that you can get. So you can get single wipe and double wipe sockets, but then you can also get these ones that it's like a pin, and in the back of it, instead of having a double wiper, it's just got a little round nickel socket, nickel hole that the legs of your dip package fit in nicely, and they are such a better connection.
Yeah, yeah, I know the ones. You can also get the ones that come in strips and you can chop them up to the right length as well.
Yeah, yep.
Look, I will get whatever JK have in stock. That's typically how it works.
Give me your finest socket.
Yeah, yeah. Give me whatever you have.
Nice.
Interestingly, I did have one of those ones that you chop up and just get the length right. And I thought, oh, okay. I'd had it in my component spares for years, and I put it in. I started soldering it on, and I noticed that the solder wasn't binding to it, and it was creating a little well around the leg, and it wasn't like binding. I'm going, what is going on here? And so I took it out. I said, well, I'm not going to use that. That's just not creating a reliable joint. And then in closer inspection, it was so old that the chrome had corroded on it. And it wasn't binding to the solder properly anymore.
Yeah,
I think I'd had it in my spare parts for over 20 years and it was just done. So I said, I'm not using that.
Right, interesting. So because of the oxidization layer, the solder wouldn't bind?
Wouldn't bind to it, yeah.
So, I mean, obviously not, we're not talking about water, right? But it's sort of giving like a hydrophobic kind of response. I'm sure there's a solder equivalent.
I'm pretty sure there would be. Yeah. And I flooded it in flux, and it's just wouldn't stick to it.
It's interesting because the flux should have cleaned any of that oxidization away. That's the whole idea of it. Flux is
maybe it's all
is there to clean and make the solder flow.
It's just rust. Yeah.
Just all
rust. Maybe wouldn't the entire leg's just rust.
But it didn't have that shiny appearance to it. It was definitely dull.
Okay.
And the flux didn't help. So, that's going in the bin. Not using that.
Oh, yeah, no fun. I've just bought a new Mac Mini, the new M4 Mini. I had been keeping my eye out for a while when it was rumored there was going to be a new version coming out, especially because they're going to be they are a different form factor. But the rumors kind of knew about that about 6 months ago. Which, like, the Mac Minis have been the same external dimensions for about a decade. Like the 2013 unibody models, it's been the same since. And I make and sell a lot of Mac Mini mounts. So when the new one came out, I was like, okay, well, I'll definitely have to get the new one so I can get all the dimensions right. It's going to be pretty popular and stuff. So I ordered one straight away. Without like looking into it too much, like I got basically the base model. I upgraded the NIC. Didn't bother doing extra dimensions and stuff. Extra storage or memory. Which is good that I didn't, though, because if you add on, they come with 16 gig of RAM and 256 gig of memory of storage, right? Mm-hmm. If you double that and you go to 32 gig of RAM and 512, right, it doubles the cost of the unit. It is cheaper to buy two of them than it is to double the storage.
That's
but
Apple
it's
for
just
you.
Memory and storage.
Yeah.
It's the cheapest components on the board.
Yeah. So while the base model is like quite an attractive proposition, I think I paid like less than a grand for even with the NIC upgrade on it. To add the storage, really, really jumps it up.
That's just Apple profiteering there. To be honest, that's ridiculous.
But the bizarre thing for me, so when I saw it came out and bought it, I'm like, okay, cool. I see there's no power button on the back anymore. So the older models, they had a little button on the back that was a power button. And like in my mounts, I designed like a lever. So on the front that you could sort of pull and it would hit that button at the back. So you could do that. Now, like I sell to a lot of like AV guys, right? So they travel with their Macs all the time. They turn them on, they turn them off. The new Mac Mini, they don't have the power button on the back. They put it on the bottom.
It's literally like Underneath. Where that little curvy lip is?
Yeah, so it's got like the bulge at the bottom, which is where all the vents are. And then you got like the flat part. That's where the power button is. It's at the back, like the back left-hand side. Like, so...
Why?
It's funny because you get the sort of fanboy people that then post how like Apple can never make a design mistake. Right, like it's never Apple's. They've never like,
and then they're coming like they're wrong here.
Yeah, because what they do, they're like, oh well, when do you ever actually turn your Mac off? Like you never turn them off. They sit on your desk forever. You know, like they can't envision that people have other use cases for them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely gonna be a project for me when I get mine, which is due Tuesday, I think. I'm gonna have to develop like. A lever or a button, something that I can do that I can push from the front that'll, you know, hit that power button underneath. I've got some designs like that I think will be that will work, but I really need to do measurements and, you know, sort of prototype it, do a few rounds. So that's going to sort of keep me busy over the next couple of weeks.
That's crazy. What a stupid place to put the power button.
Yeah, it's got a little light on the front, and silly me, I was just like, oh, good, they got rid of the button on the back. It'll be a little touch button on the front. That makes sense.
No, that's way too simple.
So
that's crazy.
This is coming from the company to put the charging port for the mouse on the bottom.
Yeah, well, like, yeah, I mean, you know, that's stupid, but... Like, yeah, we were talking about this the other day, and their reasoning behind it is stupid, but I understand why they did it. So you don't have you charge it and then you take the cable away and put it away in your drawer, which never happens. You just unplug the cable and leave it on your desk. So
they don't want to see a cable on a desk. They don't want to see the mouse with a cable on it.
Oh, people are going to unplug it then put the cable away. No, people are way too lazy for that. We're just unplugging it and dropping the cable. And then using our mouse.
Never mind all the other cables on the desk. I mean, if you're a content creator, you're going to have switch boxes and...
Oh, so many, yeah.
It's just stuff all over your desk, right?
Yeah. It's like a load of the AV folks that I know, they'll have like the Mac and then they'll have like a CalDigit Thunderbolt dock that has like 20 ports hanging off it. Mm-hmm. And they'll have that connected to all sorts of gear.
All the black magic gear hanging off all that.
Yeah, exactly, right. You got all the video converters.
Because my wife's still using a Mac. She's got the MacBook Pro. And we bought her this, she bought herself this really fancy dock thing that the MacBook slides into so that it's out of the way because she doesn't use the screen on it at all unless she's remote. And on the back of this thing, it's got like the USB ports and the charging port and all that sort of stuff is all there. And all she does when she comes home of an afternoon from being in the office is just slides the Mac in and it automatically connects up to the big screen and her keyboard and mouse is all connected. Mm-hmm. She doesn't use a Mac mouse or a Mac keyboard.
Yeah.
Mm. So there's cables everywhere.
As much as I like having like a docking station that's just a USB-C port or a Thunderbolt cable, right, and plugging just that one cable in, like that is nice, but I do sometimes miss the days. Remember the old chunky docking stations that you would like?
Slide it down.
Had the special connector underneath. And
you got one over here.
And then you got the power button. You could switch it on and off. The screen never had to open.
And they've got like 8 USBs on the back of them.
And the network
slap
board
it down
and
you're done.
And they tended to always work, right? Because you'd buy it, you had a HP laptop and you had the HP dock and all the drivers worked. Whereas sometimes the USB-C ones.
A bit sketchy.
I've got the HP mobile workstation here that I'm running on. No port on the bottom of it. It has got USB-C and it's got a couple of USB-A ports and a network port and all that sort of stuff. But it's the only way you can dock with it is USB-C. Now, my screen will charge the laptop, except for when I got this new one, because it's so big and so power hungry, can't supply enough power to it. So I've got to have the charger plugged in all the time, as well as the screen, which just annoys me.
Yeah, I mean, some of the big workstation laptops can have like 200 watt power supplies. Mm. Like, it's a bit of an ask to push that over USB-C.
Yeah, USB-C. Yeah, yeah. Well, this one is. This is a... It's a Core i7. It's 32 gig of RAM. It's got an NVIDIA graphics card in it. It's like she's a bit power hungry.
All right. Well, I thought, just to shift gears a little bit, I thought the 3G shutdown would be, there'd be a lot more noise and stories about it, but there hasn't been a lot.
I mean, I was prepared. Dogs and cats getting along together, the house is going to be on fire, like end time stuff.
Nuclear explosions going off everywhere. And
but no, I mean, ABC ran a couple of stories about dear Aunt Betty, you know, she bought a phone, you know, her nephew got
32
got her a phone
years ago.
From China 2 years ago, and now it's brand new and it doesn't work anymore. Like, well, you know, that's going to happen. Yeah. But outside of that, nothing really.
Okay, well, I mean, that's good, right? It's okay to be prepared for things, and you know, it's good that there's not impacts or minimal.
The country's had enough time to sort themselves out, though. We've known about this shutdown for more than 12 months. It's been delayed for, I can't remember how long it was delayed for. It was like 9 months or something the first
couple
time
times,
around.
Yep.
So there's been more than enough time to sort it, and I'm sure there are some people out there that are affected by it. But
there'll be corner cases for sure.
There will be. There'll be people that are in the back end of nowhere that are like, "Well, I haven't seen the news in 12 months because I'm too busy watching the weather, and now my phone doesn't work. What's going on? I've got to make the 6 hour drive into the nearest town so I can get a new phone."
Yeah, yeah. But the test for us, Ian, will be when we get out bush.
Yeah.
The first time we get out bush and really see what phone reception I've got, then I'll be swearing and kicking and screaming at that point.
Yeah, well, that's right, because the 3G signal is a much longer distance signal than the 4G. The 4G is a much shorter bandwidth, shorter wavelength.
Wavelength, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Speaking of things that have crashed and burned, the ABS has been trying to get over to Copilot as part of the recent government-wide Copilot trial, but they just can't do it.
Oh, why not?
Well, see, as it turns out, a significant proportion of the ABS's information records is currently stored in Lotus Notes.
Oh, that venerable database system that sometimes pretended to be an email client.
that also sometimes pretended to be a whole heap of other things.
All in one desktop. We don't need anything
else. That's it. So Copilot can't read notes databases because, well, really nothing can except for notes itself. The ABS is only in the early stages of migrating away from notes to Microsoft SharePoint.
Oh, imagine getting that job of copy-pasting.
I'd quit. I would quit. Hey, welcome aboard. You're on our Lotus Notes migration project.
You're
going to
be
out the door.
Control-C, Control-V for the next 3 years.
Yep. Yeah, no. Well, so I used to work for a company that had a very large notes environment. And we were pushing the envelope on how big you could get the notes database. And we found out that you could get it to 49.8 gigabytes. And if you went one byte over that, the notes database was corrupt and it would never load again. So you'd set your limits, like, you know, just a little bit below that mark to the hard write limit. But anyway, so they're in the early stages of migrating away from notes and into SharePoint. But they're obviously, they've got a very large environment. It is the ABS. They've got a very large environment, and it's just not going to be a fast process. The Bureau adopted Lotus Notes and Domino back in the 90s. Like most companies back then, you know, it was the email client to have.
Oh, it was the way to go, yeah.
Yeah.
I can remember being at Telstra and they had notes, and it was just such a paradigm shift compared to, you know, your usual, you know, office suite, and then you have to jump in. I've got to go into notes. What the heck do I do when I'm in here? Yeah. Like, where do I go? And like, what do I do? Where do I find stuff?
I remember using it in the military, and it was like, what is this?
What is
this? This thing. It's ugly. It's like all yellowy, like beige colours, and all the buttons just look weird.
Very strange. Yeah.
It was strange.
It's a vastly different looking thing now.
Oh, it's been modernized somewhat.
Well, we'll use that term loosely.
It just looks different. Wasn't it? IBM sold it on.
Yeah. So it's called HCL Notes, which I can't remember what HCL stand for, what company it is. But yeah, it was because it was Lotus Notes originally because it was developed by Lotus. And then IBM bought it. They kept the Lotus Notes name, even though it was called IBM Lotus Notes then. And then HCL bought it. Now it's called HCL Notes.
Yeah, I do not have fond memories of doing desktop support for Lotus Notes.
I disliked it immensely.
All right, and just quickly before we get on with the news, what's this fine I hear coming out of Russia? What's this all about?
Oh, my God.
Largest fine ever.
The fine is so large, it's more than all of the money that's ever existed ever. And it'll be higher now, like since the articles were written, right? So basically what happened is Russia started fining Google, who hasn't had a presence in Russia for like 2 years, right? So the Google operation in Russia is effectively bankrupt. There's no one there. The banks were confiscated. Sorry, the bank accounts were confiscated. So they don't exist. However, because YouTube censored some Russian media outlets, and the Russian Supreme Court was not a fan of that, so has been leveraging fines against them that multiply for every day that they don't comply. So they just keep going up at an exponential rate, and now it's at $20 dekillion.
has reached 2 undekillion rubles, $20 dekillion. Wow.
So to borrow a phrase from a bloke that I know that's that came up with this catchphrase, more decillions are better.
the more decillions than your bank account has room for.
yeah, that's it. How many zeros is that on the end? It's like 30 odd zeros on the end, isn't it? I can't remember. It's a lot.
It's an astonishing number. It's one of those weird numbers that if you're writing it like on the calculator, it would go like E and then a minus.
Yeah. It's like the number of IP6 addresses.
Yeah.
So I don't YouTube think they're still be available in Russia.
Yeah.
YouTube is still available in Russia, but authorities have repeatedly threatened to take it offline over its ban on state-owned Russian content, which is all going to be propaganda, right?
Yeah, well, I think the go is that they don't officially want to ban YouTube because it's consumed, like Google services are still used by people in Russia. Like they might not be able to pay for it directly there, but they still want to use the services. So they don't want to ban it. However, if they leverage a large enough fine, maybe Google will shut it down on their own. I think that's the play in the background, right? They don't want to be responsible for it.
So I wonder what happens then in, because China would have much the same thing, though.
No, China, but see, China's kind of cloned all of the Google services, right? You've got Baidu
intellectual property doesn't exist in China.
No.
You just do whatever you want.
So, it's very strange. Like when you travel to China, you can't access all the Google services, but you have to use like a VPN to be able to get to it all. And they do, right? Like people in China, like heaps of people have VPNs to get through the firewall. But you do get weird things. Like you try and use Google Maps and there's a requirement that GPS not be super accurate. So you're like a couple of streets away at any point in time. So Google Maps isn't any good, but you have to use like the local Chinese one.
Yeah, right.
There's some strange things that you get.
All right, cool. Well, enough of the banter anyway. Let's get on with the rest of the show. We do have a show to produce here. Let's move on to the community news. And Ian, you put this one in here, GDG Auckland.
Yeah, so GDG Auckland's DevFest is happening on Sunday. I'm going to be there. A whole heap of other GDEs are going to be there talking about various things, including I know that there's at least one Googler going there. Brett will be talking about Flutter GPU. So if you're in Auckland this weekend, pop along to the Auckland Uni, get yourself a ticket, and come in and say good day, and we can learn stuff.
Nice. Good luck with the trip. Good. Hopefully the weather's nice over there.
Yeah, well, it's a whirlwind tour. I leave on Saturday morning at like 9 o'clock in the morning, and then I leave back for Brisbane from Auckland at 7 o'clock on Monday morning. So,
right. I mean, 2 days, that's plenty of time to see all of New Zealand. Like, how big is it, right?
Because well, I leave at 9 o'clock on Saturday morning, which means I get into Auckland at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon or 3:30 in the afternoon, something like that. Because they're 3 hours ahead of us and the plane takes like 3.5 hours. And then on the way back, I leave at 7 o'clock in the morning and I get back at 7:45.
It's a very fast plane on the way back.
It's a very fast plane on the way back. And it must be that rotation of the Earth.
Yeah.
And we're flying in a Concorde. No, oh, it's Concorde.
All right. Well, you have fun there, Ian.
Yeah, I do.
And anyone in New Zealand, yeah, make sure you catch that.
All eight people in New Zealand are going to go.
All eight people, that's it.
No, apparently they've got quite the turnout already.
Excellent. And you got that slide pack there ready?
Yeah. Always. Yeah.
Oh, that's good. All right, let's get on with the news items. And a quick one straight off the top of the bat here. I said to you guys during the week, hey, has Google search changed? There's a new thing at the top here. Turns out Google has launched AI overviews in search. Have you guys seen this? Well, of course you have.
I have.
I have. It took me by surprise.
Yeah, same. I was like, oh, hang on, what's this? And it's Google giving me an overview of the results. I love it.
And you know what? I've been using it. I have been using the heck out of it. That's my go-to now.
Yeah.
It's just like, what is this?
I haven't used it too much yet. I first ran into it because I was trying to work out some whether or not you can ship wine internationally and what the restrictions were depending on where it goes and stuff. And then I start seeing this AI thing come back and I'm like, I'm not trusting that with customs rulings and stuff
when it comes to, because you don't know what country it's sourcing it from,
yeah, exactly.
Right? But here's the thing. Here's the way I'm using it. It gives you a guide. It gives you a pointer. Mm. It gives you a direction on where to go. It's like I'm finding my searches that I put in now are more like AI prompts.
Yeah. Right?
And so with that, I get the overview back and I go, okay, so I want to try and find the source of that. And so then it gives you, with the previews of the searches below, it gives you a bit more direction on which page you might want to go to. It kind of gives you a starting point.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, I've been trying to learn a new skill this week in that we're just about to buy a 3D printer. So I've been hounding Dave for lots of information on what to use and where to go to get tutorials and what printer to buy and all this sort of stuff. Hmm. But I've been using it just to find information on the different software that's out there and try and figure out what I can use and what I can't use because I don't have a Windows machine in the house. Mm-hmm. And my wife probably wouldn't like it if I took over her Mac.
Mm-hmm. Just remote desktop, though, it's fine.
While she's working.
Yeah.
VNC. Well, I've got a printer down in the garage, which is an Ender, and it's just software's on Linux. I got it off a mate of mine a little while ago. I haven't used it yet, so maybe I'll when I do fire it up, I'll let you know how that works. Maybe that'll help you.
Yeah, well, we're looking at the Bamboo Labs A1 with the multi-color unit, so it can feed 4 different color filaments in at the same time.
Oh, nice!
And you don't have to sort of pull the filament out and change it over to a new color and then extrude a bit out to clean the nozzle into the new color and everything. It's quite nice, but we'll see how it goes.
Excellent. Well, let's not go down a 3D printed rabbit hole.
No,
just
let's not.
Now.
No,
man, we could have a 3D printer podcast.
Yeah,
we've got Mr. 3D printer here, I know. So this article talking about AI overviews in search says it was in labs, but now they've launched it in more than 100 countries and making it accessible in more languages. So, yeah, get in there next time you're doing a search. Have a go at the AI overviews. Very cool.
Love it.
All right, so it's just a quickie. And moving on, a quick finance update here. Google outpaces AWS and Azure. So this is an article on CNBC. Google's cloud outpaces rivals in third quarter as AI battle heats up. The TLDR on this is Google's cloud business grew 35% in last quarter, not bad, outpacing larger rivals Amazon and Microsoft. Amazon Web Services continue to rank in profit, recording an operating margin of the quarter of 38%. It's just comparing the two. Both Amazon and Microsoft said demand for artificial intelligence services is outstripping their supply. So, yeah, Google grew 35% year over year in the third quarter to $11.35 billion, accelerating from 29% in the prior period. Quite nice.
Yeah, that's really good. And I think that's the case for, like, the demand for AI is outstripping supply for all of the major vendors, to totally. Be honest. I mean, we're struggling at work to get access to instance sizes in Australia.
Yep. I had a similar problem with the project I was on recently as well.
Yep. It's a common issue that there's just not enough GPUs and CPUs around to do the stuff that we want to do.
Yep. Even TIN. I've been on a couple of VMware projects recently. Even get a reservation for bare metal at the moment is difficult. The supply is just not there.
It's that, which is such a foreign concept now. You know, for years we were talking about, you don't have to worry about it. You can just provision it, you scale up as what, you know, whatever you need. Yeah. The fact that we're now hitting like hard limits where the hyperscalers don't have TIN for you.
Well, you remember when we were on the first GCVE migration project in the country. And it was just like, you don't have to worry about any of this. Just like, if you need another node, just add another node. No one cares. There's always going to be capacity there.
Yeah.
And now it's like, well, you know, you probably need to plan your resourcing fairly well because there might not be a node there for you.
Yep.
Yeah. It's really, really fascinating. Yeah. But the thing is like, if you're going to have issues like that, then that will push some people back on-prem.
Well,
if that's the only place you can go to get what you need.
Yeah. And I read an article yesterday just in my newsfeed on my phone that said that there is actually a shift away from cloud back to on-prem data centers because we're having supply issues in cloud.
Well, I mean, that doesn't help the situation. I mean, there's always going to be a shift back to on-prem. It's like vinyl records. Vinyl records are coming back. Records are coming back, right? They've been coming back for 20 years, right? They never really went away, right? So it's the shift to on-prem. You know, as much as the hyperscalers want on-prem to go away, I don't think it's ever truly going to go away. There's always going to be some on-prem, right? And, I don't think it's a shift per se. It's just going to be perpetual.
Right.
Yeah, it's just that it is what it is. It's going to remain. I mean, this article. Sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, like, the only thing that I would say for, you know, where some companies have actually decided to actively switch back, I would at least hope now, though, that companies would take more of like the practices that they learned in the cloud and bring that to on-prem.
Yeah,
make
definitely.
Things more efficient.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. The whole DevOps and CICD side of things. Yeah.
DevOps and SRE practices and all that sort of stuff that you do. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just lower that operational burden.
Hmm.
In this article does go on to make that point. It says the Amazon CEO, Andy Jassy, has said, I think pretty much everyone today has less capacity than they have demand for. And it's really primarily chips that are the area where companies could use more supply. You know, we're seeing, Intel, Nvidia.
Yeah, yep.
You know, Amazon and Google are both making their own chips. I don't know where they get them fabbed at, but, you know, they've got to wait for fab time to get those made up.
Yep.
And the article also does go on to say, an analyst at DA Davidson said in a note this week that they don't see this as a battle Microsoft can win going up against Amazon and Google. And that's primarily around the chips, right?
Mm. It's interesting because I read this morning. I've been awake since like 4 o'clock. So, you know, I've been trawling the news as you do. And I did read this morning that Nvidia is looking to get into the desktop market with an ARM CPU.
Oh, that'd be cool. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm, so it's like Nvidia sees that GPUs are not the be all and end all. They need to diversify a little bit, and getting into ARM GPUs seems like a sensible option.
Or they can just go pick up Intel. Everybody else wants to take a bite again.
You know, buying Intel.
Sniff around
Apple
Intel
trying to buy Intel. Samsung trying to buy Intel. Everyone.
All of the people want to buy Intel.
All right. So let's move on anyway. Speaking of DevOps and all things CI/CD, the Dora report was released, and the developer productivity up, delivery performance down, Google Dora reports fines. The Google Cloud DevOps Research Assessment Dora program this week released its 10th annual report. This is an article off IT Pro today, revealing a complex interplay between artificial intelligence adoption and software development performance. Now, this is a little bit surprising, I thought. Just to break it down here, AI adoption, more than 75% of developers now use AI daily. Quality improvements, a 25% increase in AI adoption correlates with 7.5% better documentation, 3.4% improved code quality, and 3.1% faster code reviews. There are some performance challenges, though. Despite productivity gains, increased AI adoption shows 7.2% decline in delivery stability and 1.5% decrease in delivery throughput. While boosting developer productivity, particularly in large organizations, implementation of platform engineering initially causes temporary performance decreases. Interesting, right? And finally, the developer experience, unstable priorities and consistent pivoting negatively impact performance, even when other positive organizational forces are present. So I think that last point there is probably the most telling. Companies have been shifting and pivoting and saying, yeah, we've got to get on the AI, let's go there. But that, in the short term anyway, has actually made a negative impact on performance and outputs.
I think another telling thing here is the AI adoption shows a 7.2% decrease in delivery stability, which tells me that the developers that are using it aren't considering the bigger picture of their environment before they're implementing the changes that AI is suggesting to their code.
Right. So productivity is up because the AI helped me write some code.
Yeah.
But delivery performance is down because the AI code wasn't great.
Yeah. Or more that the AI code might have been fantastic, but it might not have fit exactly the way that their stack works or their application works or something like that. It doesn't have that big picture of this is how the application works. So yeah, I think that performance challenges one is quite telling.
This is where you need, the large context windows. Does that help in this case, or does the AI still really not have the context of the use of the code?
I don't think the AI has the. I don't even think it's the use of the code context. I think it's the big picture on how the application works. Like that's a very, a developer has to have in their head exactly how this application sticks together and how each different part of it is supposed to function. And just using AI to say, hey, generate me a bit of code for login from Google and then just, yep, let's just throw that in there. That looks like it'll work.
Yeah.
That's where you come unstuck, because that might not actually work with your backend. Your backend might need a certain token to be stored in a certain place or something like that. I'm just sort of random example.
Yeah, I'm thinking for UI and the user experience on the on a UI. How does it know how the UI is going to flow? And we talked about Lotus Notes before, and that is the opposite of good UX and flowing workspace. But you know what I mean? Like it needs to work properly. The one thing I do know about UI design and the UX and UI design, when you close something, you should go back to the point from which you opened that thing.
That's right.
Right? Now, when an app doesn't do this and you close it and it sends you all the way back to the top menu or something, it is infuriating. And that's the kind of thing that AI might just decide to do randomly, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And or the other one is if I create a record, there's two options. I should be able to create and close the record, or I should be able to create the record and then go into it, because there might need to be other information that needs to be attached to it. Mm-hmm. That sort of thing. Again, that leads back to that point of the AI doesn't have that full context of how this application works. So the suggestions that it makes are just suggestion. That's all it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it still is up to the developer, and this is where this quality improvement thing I find interesting is, yeah, okay, it's a 25% increase in AI adoption correlates with 7.5% better documentation. AI is great at documenting code. It really is. It gives you faster code reviews and all that sort of stuff. That's fantastic, because you can point out, like, you can get a summary of the code. It's good at documenting the code. It's good at giving you a review of the code. But that leads to a 1.5% decrease in delivery throughput, because the errors that go into the code, because you've used AI to generate it, AI to review it. And if you've seen my talk on Slackbots with Gemini, you'll know that the Gemini is very good at complementing itself. leads to a 1.5% decrease in delivery throughput, because you've got to go back and fix it all the time.
I mean, it does sound like even just using it for the documentation side alone would be just a nice benefit, because developers are terrible at that.
Yeah. Yeah, I use it all the time to document our Terraform code.
Mm. Mm. Write this in plain English.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Mm. That's nice. Yeah, I'll have to do that. look, I mean, the numbers are small. You know, it's 1.5. Yeah. I like to think this is teething, right? Like, people are getting used to the idea. We're sure trying to work it. I remember when Google Search launched. Yes, I'm this old.
Yep.
I remember when I was working in IT and Google Search launched. Prior to that, Alta Vista, Dogpile, maybe Yahoo Search, right?
Yahoo Search and Alta Vista were my two.
And they were terrible, right? And then this Google thing launched. It's like, that's it. I don't need to know anything anymore. Yeah. This does it all for me.
You're like, I need to fix this thing on Windows. I better pull out my MCSC manuals and then...
Oh yeah,
I had a whole heap of books in my cubicle on stuff that I would refer to. Still got one floating around here that I use every now and then. But yep, don't need them anymore.
I've still got them. They're sitting on the shelf in the cupboard here. I still use them all the time.
Yep. So it's kind of that, but in 2024 format, right?
Yep.
People have got to work out how to use it. All right, cool. Let's move on then. Dave. You know, I usually don't put stuff in about Google Cloud outages, but what drew, because that happened all the time, what drew your attention to this one?
So I thought this one was kind of interesting. This is an article from The Register talking about an outage that happened in the Frankfurt region, or the Europe West 3 region, back on the 24th of October. It's a couple of weeks back now. And I think the interesting thing for me, and it's a little quick one, but again, it's just power issues, right? They got a loose cable. Loose cable here takes out, you know, a data hall.
You know, load of services impacted. Tighten the screws on the mains connector.
Yeah. So, it's definitely something to I guess, think about, like, the underlying infrastructure that has to feed any individual location. You do still have all the redundancy across, you know, compute and everything. But if the power drops, you're losing. Yeah,
it's still a data center.
It's still a data center.
It's just
it's
the same
place.
As if you have stuff in a data center. It's just someone else's stuff.
Yeah. So it's usually a pretty stable, you know, place, this particular region. They don't usually have too many dramas, but, yeah, certainly copped it on this one. But it was just the one, so, if you had multi-region, you were okay, but plenty of services still were impacted.
I find it astonishing that a loose power cable caused a 12-hour, 39-minute outage, though. That's a long time to plug a power cable back in.
It takes a long time to walk around and find all the little wiggly ones.
That one didn't have the UPS plugged in properly.
Did I ever tell you guys about the HP Net server, the NetWare HP Net server?
No.
So I went to a site one time and there was a VMware HP Net. Remember the big stand-up-y ones? We were going to decommission it, and we knew it was online. We could see it online. We could see its IPX address.
IPX and, SPX.
Novell, baby.
Hell yeah! And we could not find this thing for love nor money. So we ended up tracing some cables out. We found a blue cable that went somewhere. We followed that through. It joined up with a power cable that went somewhere. We followed both of those.
As in like an extension lead?
As an extension lead, and it went into a gyprock wall on the other side. Like no socket, nothing, through a hole
just
in a gyprock wall.
Yeah.
Server's got to be in there, right? It's got to be in there. We pulled the cable out. Sure enough, it went offline. It's got to be in there. Walked all the way around. There was no way to get into this space. What the builders had done when they refurbished the room is kept the server online and literally boxed it into a little isolated room by itself. So we had to get the sledgehammer and knock a wall down to get that server out.
Oh my gosh.
No way to get to it.
Couldn't physically get to it. It was boxed inside a little gyprock tomb.
It's the sarcophagus.
To be preserved forevermore.
Yeah. But it'd been running for about 3 years with no one maintaining it or servicing it. It's just been running.
Well, thankfully, that's what happens when you don't let fingers near it.
That's right.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so.
Wow. That's
my war stories.
That's hilarious.
That's a good one. I like that.
I was going to bring up because this is all a power outage. And I used to work for a company once that had what can be best described. They had two racks in a data center. And they had this cabling method that can be best described as the waterfall cabling method. As in, they had switches at the top of the rack and the cables were plugged into the switches and just left to hang. And so were the power cables. Oh. But they didn't bother, like, the switches were Dell Power, Power Connect, I think they were called back then. They had like a little retainer that used to clip down on top of the IEC connector. And none of them were put on. They were just all ignored. And so what had happened is, because of this waterfall cabling method, the rack would overheat and it'd start shutting stuff down. So the company decided, okay, we're getting overheating problems. Let's put a big cooling unit on the back of the rack. So big APC rack. Massive big cooling unit that creates a whole heap of vibration in a rack that's got sans and all sorts of stuff in it.
And power cables that aren't restrained.
And so what happens? The core switch, which is the only one that connects it to the internet, and everybody that's using this service, starts slowly rattling itself out. And in the middle of the night, it comes out completely and drops.
It's wireless.
And so here I am. I'm 2.5 hours away from this data center. And I get a phone call at 2 o'clock in the morning going, "This everything's offline. You need to fix it now. It's all broken." And I'm
the
like,
"The switch is down. Like
physically
the switch
down.
Is literally
and I'm
down.
Literally, I'm trying to jump onto the VPN. It's not working. I'm using our provider, the internet provider. They've given us sort of a backdoor VPN. So I've jumped onto that and I can't ping our switch, our core switch. And I'm like, well, this is not good. So So what I didn't realize was because we had they had like a 48 volt backup unit as well on this thing. So the Dell switches had the mains and then the 48 volt input. The power cable and the 48 volt backup had also come out beforehand. So I didn't realize that because I'm not alerting on that one because that's the backup.
Yeah.
I'm only alerting on the mains, assuming that the 48 volt will be fine. And so here I am driving to the data center at 2 o'clock in the morning trying to figure out why it's broken and calling the data center trying to get access to it because, you know, we're in a P1 incident and the data center's not answering their phone. They're like, no, you've got to put this thing in over the internet. And I'm like,
I'm in the car
driving at the moment, champ, and we've got a P1 incident. Can you just put it in for me? Only to find that the issue was the power cable had just dropped out.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Old power, eh?
Yep.
So, yeah.
3 hours of outage.
More power stories about data centers, no doubt. That's going to be the number one issue.
You're going to hear one soon, later on in this podcast.
We will hear another one later on the podcast. Yes. Yep. But let's move on. CrowdStrike.
Yeah.
God. No one likes CrowdStrike. What's going on here?
No one does like CrowdStrike at the moment. Like, okay. They released some, we'll call it, not quite as well tested as it should have been, updates that bricked a whole heap of computers all around the world.
8.5 million.
Yeah, yeah, just a couple. And so, of course, there's some companies that are fairly unhappy with this, Delta Airlines being one of them.
Mm.
And so Delta Airlines is suing CrowdStrike, as we've covered previously. CrowdStrike has decided they're going to counter-sue Delta Airlines. And CrowdStrike is doing this to make it clear that CrowdStrike did not cause the harm that Delta claims and that Delta repeatedly refused assistance from both CrowdStrike and Microsoft. Now, this one comes as a bit of a...
It wouldn't have helped.
No. Well, this one comes as a bit of a... It seems counterintuitive to counter-sue on these grounds because at the end of the day, you release software that bricked a whole heap of Windows machines all around the world, and the only way to unbrick them was to physically be at the machine to fix them up.
So CrowdStrike now saying they would have had the resources to go and do that? I find that unlikely.
And this is the thing. So I'm saying, okay, so I find it very hard to believe that Delta Airlines and all of their IT management people would refuse help from both CrowdStrike and Microsoft to fix an issue that is downing their entire platform. So, I mean, Delta filed their lawsuit and they called the update catastrophic and they've said that it's forced untested and faulty updates to its customers, causing more than 8.5 million Windows-based computers around the world to crash. And they're saying that this has cost the carrier more than $500 million, which is a lot of million.
Which actually, I mean, that seems pretty reasonable. I would have thought.
Yeah.
Potentially, it could have been a lot more,
well,
right?
That's just Delta.
That's just Delta.
Can you just think of, okay, Qantas as another one that uses CrowdStrike and is using Windows machines. Virgin also uses CrowdStrike and is using Windows machines. It's just in Australia. So there's the two biggest airlines in Australia down. Jetstar is a subsidiary of Qantas, so they're also using the same platform, so they're down. And these are just small airlines in Australia. Delta is a much bigger airline in the US, and you've got American Airlines, and you've got a whole heap of other smaller carriers in the US that would also be using this same software. So, look, I think this is going to be an interesting one to watch.
Yep. And they're probably not the first major user of this software that's going to go into some sort of class action with this.
Well, they're the first ones that filed a lawsuit against CrowdStrike, and I think all the others are sitting back going, we'll see what happens here, because the minute that gets through and they set the precedent, we're all jumping on board. And I think that's what that's why CrowdStrike is counter-suing, because they're like, oh, hang on, this is going to open the floodgates. And then all of a sudden, if we're proved negligent, our insurance no longer covers us.
Yep. So they're trying to get on the front foot with it.
Yep.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right. See how it plays out in court, hey?
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Another little follow-up story. Optus.
Yeah.
Optus compensated users $1.2 million for lost income from 2023 outage.
Yeah. So we all remember the outage that that Optus had. They've compensated $1.2 million in cash and service credits. So compensation for the unplanned outage was a major customer complaint, and Optus offered mostly extra data quota in order to compensate users, which I think, to be honest, is a bit, you know.
How does that help? Like, it probably expires, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
I never use all my data anyway.
Yeah, that's
maybe
right.
Maybe 2% of it.
Yeah, that's it. I'd be lucky if I use 1% a month because I'm on Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi here. Yeah. In the inquiry report, ex-Optus chief Kelly Bayer Rosmarin said most customers would be entitled to only to between $1 and $2 in financial compensation. She then told the inquiry in mid-November last year that 8,500 customers had made claims for $430,000, of which Optus has paid out $36,000. So a new set of figures shows a subset of the complainants, 1,154 of them, ultimately succeeded in being compensated by the telco specifically for lost income. So this is an interesting telltale. Collectively, $481,000 in cash and $761,800 in service credits for a total of $1.4 million.
Mm.
So, yeah, they've shelled out a lot more than what they thought back in 2023. The $1 and $2 per user seems a little bit low to me.
Yeah.
The $480,000 seems a lot more realistic.
Yeah. Well, at least, you know, I think early on they were saying we're not even going to compensate people.
Well, so technically they don't have to compensate consumers, but if you're on a business contract, then there will be SLAs in the business contract, which is why you pay so much for it. So they would have to compensate businesses. And that there's all of those claimants, there's like 15 enterprise customers who secured $282,000 in service credits, and SMBs were 75%.
All right. Well, we'll just keep an eye on that, see if there's going to be any more compensation come from Optus. But you threw in another story here, Ian, on Google Pixel face unlocks.
Yeah. So we remember the old face unlock that was on the Pixels, Pixel 4, I think it was, that had the face unlock that you just needed a photo of yourself. And you can unlock the phone.
And I remember having that on mine during the pandemic, and like it sucked because he had masks on all the time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I missed fingerprint at that time.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm just going to say, I hate it. It just should not be a thing. No. Face unlock is the worst thing ever. Anyway, go on.
Yeah. So, yeah, look, I agree. Face unlock was a massive pain during the pandemic, and it's not that much better at the moment. Back in the Pixel 4 days, you could have your eyes closed in front of the camera and it would unlock the phone. You could hold a photo of yourself, mm-hmm. and it didn't even have to be a good one. It could be someone's printed out on a 20-year-old bubble jet printer a photo of you from 1992, and it unlocks the phone. I'm sure it was just looking at the shape of your face and going, looks good to me.
And it's slow. I find it slow.
Yeah.
It's actually quicker. Let's not get into the thumbprint reader on the new Pixel phones. The previous with the thumbprint at the back, that was logging Utopia. But
I missed the back one. Back one was best.
It's quicker. The back one's the way to go.
Yep. Yeah, that's
But yeah, you know, when it does work, the thumbprint's much quicker.
Yeah, that's right. So what's happening here is Google is considering adding an under-display IR camera to the Pixel 11, and this is all based on a leak from Google's chip division. This would enable more secure and versatile face unlock, much the same as what Apple's got, where it's sort of looking at a whole heap of different features, which addresses the limitations of the current face authentication system that relies on the color front-facing camera. And the Tensor G6 chip is expected to support new IR camera system, potentially matching Apple's planned under-display Face ID technology for 2026.
It's actually pretty crazy seeing so many leaks now about potential Pixel 11 stuff. We're seeing more of that than Pixel 10 stuff. We're two generations ahead in the leaks.
Yeah. So I suppose it's you got to think Google is probably they've already probably got the Pixel 10 designed, and they're just sort of finalizing a few flaws.
Well, I mean, chip design takes a fair while before you get to tape out and actually, producing. Yeah. So
I would assume that given that we would be looking, so the 9 came out last year. Is it last year? Yeah.
Yeah, you get one every year. So you would expect to see the 10 around September next year. And then, so we're talking 22 months from now.
Yeah.
2026.
Yeah.
Yeah. Still not going to use it.
No.
I don't actually have Face ID set up on mine. I turned it off.
Hate it. And I'll go fingerprint, and my wife doesn't even have fingerprint, she just goes pin. That's it. And it's quicker. It's more reliable.
Yep. I used to do the old pattern. I love the pattern.
Yeah. The
pattern was good.
Pattern's good.
Yep.
That's still an old login option, isn't it?
I'm sure it is.
Yep. All right. Well, let's see how it pans out. And I'll be curious as to watch the first sort of reviews of that when it comes out. And I can't imagine it'll be good. That's my prediction.
Yep.
And just before we get on to the AI wars, old Melon Husk, he's got to be up to something, aside from supporting certain political candidates, which are no longer candidates, he's gone and created his own search engine, Explore.
I feel like he's on our episodes every single fortnight. Fortnight we're covering something about Melon Husk.
Just quickly here, Elon Musk is no stranger to disruption. From electric cars to space exploration, his ventures have consistently pushed the boundaries. This time, could Explore be the next big thing to challenge Google's dominance in search? Find that unlikely. he's launched some new search engine. Honestly, I didn't read this whole article. I couldn't be bothered. So I don't think it's going to
It's interesting insofar as from what this article is saying, he's looking at not only a search engine, which I'm assuming he's going to be pulling data from both Google and Microsoft's indexes, but he's also integrating Grok AI into it. So
of course,
much the same as what we've got with Google, where you've got the AI summaries at the top, is what we're expecting.
Just to read a paragraph here, one of the most intriguing aspects of Explore would be its ability to integrate data from X, formerly Twitter. I mean, that's just how we say it now, isn't it?
Yeah.
We don't.
Yeah, they haven't shortened the name. It's not Twitter has gone to X. It's X, formerly Twitter.
Yeah, into its search algorithms, right? Unlike Google, which primarily relies on web crawlers and search algorithms to optimize over decades, Explore could tap into vast real-time data generated by millions of X users, I'm not going to say it, worldwide. This could allow Explore to offer search results that not only relevant but timely. And I have to say that is kind of one of the, fallbacks or problems with Google. You search and it's an article from 2012.
Yeah.
You go, this is 10 years old. The software I'm trying to has moved on since then. I know you can do advanced searches and stuff and put dates and stuff around it, but it needs to be more relevant. It needs to do that automatically. So this feature would do that. But it's pulling from X. I mean, X is a cesspool these days. I've uninstalled it from my phone. I'm about this far away from actually going and having my asking for my account to be deleted.
I've got Blue Sky now. That's where I've gone to.
Honestly, is it relevant anymore other than like the cesspit that it is?
Look, it's just another social media network as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. They're all as bad as each other. I mean, yeah, okay, there's not the moderation on X that there used to be when it was Twitter. But they're all much of a muchness. There's just people voicing their opinions, and some of them shouldn't be allowed to.
Yeah, some are louder than others, and some get the traction that shouldn't get the traction. Yeah, all right, but, you know, I can't see it being a Google killer. You know, I've always said when your product becomes a verb, it's successful, right? So, the term to Google something, it's become a verb, right? And it's in the vernacular now. Like, it's hard to beat that, hard to get that out of the popular vernacular.
Yeah, I can't really sort of fathom the idea of, just explore that. That's just not going to work for me.
No, I like to bing it. That's how I'm a
you like to bing it, yeah.
I can't remember
how to get
the
wrong results first time every time. Bing.
I'm just going to Google it on Bing.
Yeah.
The verb is Google, right? Yeah, you can Google. I'll Google that on some random search engine. All right. So let's see how to maybe. I don't want to do it. Maybe we need to have the Explore challenge when they launch it, and we'll each spend a week on Explore and not Google things.
Oh, let's make it a more realistic goal of spending a day, shall we?
A day.
Yeah, I'll give you 20 minutes.
Yeah. I might search on it for 20 minutes, but they're just across the entire day.
We've got to use it. We do this so our listeners don't have to, okay?
Yeah, we're taking one for the team here. That's
it. All right. Should we do it? Let's do it. Let's get on with the AI Wars.
Well, I guess so. Related to Explore, I guess a kind of a follow-up article for us. So last week, or last fortnight, sorry, in the last podcast, we talked about the 100,000 GPU cluster that was supposedly set up in 19 days.
Yep.
Mm-hmm, right, which we were skeptical about, but the fact is, while it wasn't 19 days, it was still damn quick. Right, so Patrick Kennedy at servethehome.com, he got access to the Colossus facility, right? And he got special access while it was being built and after it's gone live. So he's posted an amazing article and YouTube video about this Colossus data center. And he tours around it. He goes through all the heating, cooling, power. I find this to be absolutely fascinating. It's astonishing the gear that's in there. And if I can sort of geek out a little bit about it, like some of the equipment. So 122 days is what it was built in. Right. So not 19,
that's
but
quick.
4 months.
Yeah.
Right.
Still bloody quick.
That's really
just quick. Just astonishingly quick. Right. They've got 4 data halls with 25,000 GPUs in each hall. Right. So those are made up of, they have like, it's all super micro gear. Right. Yep. So they have Super Micro's liquid cooled racks and liquid cooled universal GPU nodes. These are 4 node, 4 RU nodes. Yep. So in each rack, so you've got 8 GPUs in a node, 8 nodes in a rack, and then they're made up in like groups of 8 racks for 512 GPUs across, and 25,000 GPUs in a total data center. So you can sort of extrapolate how many racks that is all up. The really cool thing is all the CPUs and GPUs are water cooled. Right, because there's so much power and so much heat that's coming off these.
Cooling is astonishing.
Yeah. So I don't know if you guys have ever experimented with like water cooling in like PCs in the past and how much of like a bear it is to do.
Yeah. It's a pain in the backside.
Yeah, it really is. So
I watch enough Linux tech tips to know that it's a pain in the
backside. Yeah, it's more effort than it's worth. However, at this scale, and right, trying to deal with this level of heat, each GPU has its own water block. So you've got the 8 in the server plus the CPUs themselves. they feed off to a manifold, then the node water cooling is then plumbed into the rack water cooling. And at the bottom of the unit, you've got this massive cooling distribution unit that has redundant pumps, and it's all hot swappable. Like, everything is serviceable across the entire rack. If you need to do maintenance on a node, you basically have like these little quick disconnects, and you can pop off the hot and cold pipes, slide the rack out, do the maintenance, slide it back in.
Pop it back in. Away you go. It. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Has a little valve in it and just shuts it off when you pull it out.
Yeah. Little ball valves in them. Yeah. So, I was just looking at the photos down the aisles in this, and it is like as a cabling neatness nerd, this is like nirvana to me.
Yeah.
I'm looking at all these pipes and they're all exactly the same across every rack, across the entire way down the aisle. I'm like, oh. It's so neat.
It's so well done. And then
the main intake pipe coming into the data hall is huge.
It is. So yeah. He stands next to it in the video. And he's a pretty solid guy. These pipes are significant. Like, he could crawl through one of these pipes.
They're
just enormous. He puts his hands on them. He's like, I can feel all the water flowing through them. Mm. Right. Now, each one of the nodes, so besides all the GPUs, each GPU has a 400 gig NIC attached to it, and then there's one for the CPU as well. So that each node has 9 400 gig NICs.
Wow.
Run them off them. Which are NVIDIA Bluefield 3 Super NICs with DPUs. Like, it's some absolutely intense power. And then, you know, of course, then they also have, like, other racks that are just standard, just CPUs for the sort of compute side. Then you've got your storage nodes.
How do you backhaul that? Like, each, so there's 9 400 gig NICs on each node. That's obviously going to a top of rack switch of some description, or a top of rack cluster of switches. How do you backhaul that amount of bandwidth?
Yeah, they have these giant, it's NVIDIA switches that are, I can't remember, Spectrum X switches, I think is what they're called, that are handling all that traffic flowing from the GPUs to the compute side and back again. Right, it's outstanding. The other thing that's really cool, because each rack itself has to be thermally neutral to the data hall. So it's not a traditional DC where it has like a hot aisle and a cold aisle.
Cold, yep.
Yeah. So, yes, the CPUs and the GPUs have the water blocks, but servers still have, you know, memory chips and power supplies and all sorts of things that do still need fans. Mm-hmm. So while there are fans at the back of the units, they then have a back of rack heat exchanger, which is also plumbed into the rack water cooling. Right. Yeah, so you can stand at the back of the racks where all the heat is being dumped out, and it's fine. So the data halls themselves don't have like massive air handling units.
Right.
Wow.
It's all carried away with the liquid cooling.
Yeah, it's all carried
away. I just saw the photo of the heat exchangers on the racks, and wow.
Yeah, very, very clean. So all that heat, GPUs to the rack to the cooling unit, and then down into those massive distribution pipes that then go to these big outside chillers to cool everything back down, and then pipe it all back through the facility. And then the other thing that was really nifty is, because the power demand is so high, not just at steady state, but between training runs of the AI, because like you'll have these like drops and climbs and stuff, so power is super fluctuating. It's so much power drain. They had to put Tesla Megapack batteries outside the unit, outside the facility. So generators charge the megapacks, and the megapacks run the facility, because the generators couldn't handle the fluctuations.
Right.
No.
That keeps the power draw consistent on the generators.
Yeah, because otherwise you'd have brownouts and then you'd have white spikes.
Yeah. So I would just really recommend that everyone goes in, like, just checks out this video. It's like 15 minutes. But the engineering behind it all, it's just gorgeous through the facility. And I think they're planning on quadrupling it. I think they want to get it to 400,000 nodes.
Just from a cabling nerd's perspective, it's pretty to look at. Yeah. It really is. And not just the fiber cabling is all nicely fanned out from the back of the switches and everything. Like, Like, that's cool, but the plumbing is also nicely the plumbing. Routed.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. Yeah, the whole thing is. Actually, one other thing that's pretty funky is all of the, like, the data transfer for the GPUs, they're not even using anything sort of niche like InfiniBand or the, you know, that kind of protocols you tend to see in, like, supercomputers. It's Ethernet. Like, yes, it's 400 gig Ethernet, but it's still Ethernet because they need to scale to so many devices that InfiniBand just can't handle it.
Can't,
So, yeah, well worth checking out. Really, really cool.
Yep.
It is cool. Ian, if you want to nerd out over some other cabling, check out a YouTube channel called The Cable Ninja.
Oh, yes, I've seen that. Yes.
You've seen him? Yeah, he's good. Yep.
I do like looking at a rack that has nice, neat cabling, and you can see where everything goes, and it's it's clean. It makes maintaining it
and service it. And,
makes maintaining it easy. And that is just me going back to my days as a systems engineer, where I would have to look after racks like that. The the whole looking after the waterfall cabling method is a nightmare because you don't know where anything goes.
You do not.
You just trace it out, don't you?
You can do, but. You know,
it is a worry when you move those cables and you just get hit with a wall of heat.
Well,
from the other side
or you move the cables and about half of them disconnect because they don't have the little tab on the Ethernet connector anymore.
Throw those ones in the bin.
No, I've reused them when I was putting the server in.
That's exactly what used to happen.
Well, you can bet the guys at this data center aren't dealing with that sort of crap.
No.
And it's a lot easier when you build things greenfield, right? Let's see what this looks like in 10 years' time.
Yeah.
When they've had people in there plugging things in and out and moving stuff around.
It'd probably shut down. It'd be ancient. It's been swallowed out
by then. Although I'd imagine they had pretty strict protocols around what they can and can't do. Cool. All right. And one more for the AI Wars this week. This is AI agents that will take control of your browser. Now, Google reportedly looking to sidestep the complexity of AI-driven automation by letting its multimodal large language models take control of your browser. What the heck?
So, okay, so I guess for me, like, having read this and seeing that, like, this article also references what Anthropic's Claude is doing, where it seems like it is much more getting it to, like, yes, take control of the browser, and Claude is more like taking control of your PC. This is sort of taking, do you remember, like, RPA, you know, robotic process automation, and a lot of open this browser, click on this thing, like automating all that sort of stuff. Seems like, so, well, we just throw AI to do it for you instead.
Yeah. The old Selenium test suite.
Yeah. There you go.
I don't know that I'm going to give Gemini permission in my browser. And if Google forces that on me in Chrome, then sorry, I'm going to Opera.
It does say it will unlock a huge range of applications that simply aren't possible for the current generation of AI assistants. So I guess you could have the AI doing some work for you in the browser.
Keep my computer alive while I'm going to have a sleep.
Clicking on things, you know. Would you really want an AI doing that?
No. That's not super exciting for me.
Yeah. No, I think the whole idea of having an AI controlling my browser and doing stuff on my behalf scares me a little bit because especially when you're working on production systems like I am on a company that relies 100% on the website that it runs being up all the time and responsive, one wrong move by the AI, and we've seen this in the article that we covered with developers using AI and it reducing the stability. I'm not into that.
The article does go on, you know, let's say using the AI to like interpret a spreadsheet or maybe read some of your emails or whatever, right? It does go on to say misinterpreting a line chart may actually be the least of your worries, especially when given access to the internet. As Anthropic was quick to warn, these capabilities could be hijacked by prompt injection schemes, hiding instructions in web pages that override the model's behavior.
Yep.
You don't want that to happen.
No, I'm not. I'm certainly not a fan of this idea. Google will have to do a lot of convincing to make me become a believer of this.
Yeah, well, you know, Google's trying to get their little AI mitts into sort of every corner and every aspect of everything, right?
Well, I mean, I did see something actually pretty cool. I don't think we had it as an agenda item today, but I think I saw yesterday that Google's claimed that their Big Sleep model like identified a security issue in SQLite. It's like the first time that like a security bug has been caught. Now, technically, they didn't release the code, so it didn't make it out into production. It's kind of not even a 0 day. It's kind of like a minus 1 day.
Right.
But
while it was in development.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah.
So that's pretty cool. That, it was, I think, just yesterday that sort of came out.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how far they go with this. I can't see it being very popular, to be honest with you. Although it might be popular with the masses that don't understand the implications of it. That's the thing. And then it'll just get pushed onto everyone else.
It's another thing to help push the old dead internet theory, right? It's just now I don't even need to be in front of my computer.
Yeah, that's right.
Can just shit post on my behalf.
Don't give it access to Reddit. Yeah. All right, guys, we'll probably finish up on that note, hey?
Yeah, sounds good. I think we're done.
It's been a good show. We gashbagged a lot at the start of the show, but hopefully there was some content in there for you guys to take away. Don't forget, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music. Go to Apple Podcasts, write us a review to really help the show out. And while you're at YouTube, why don't you smash that like button and start the discussion there? That'd be really good. You can contact the show, contact@gcpbytes.com.au. And we're on the web, www.gcpbytes.com.au. And Ian, our website's still going strong. It's good to see some good quality code there, mates. And today's show is sponsored by Hivetech Solutions and Mantle Group. That's about it from me. Anything from you guys?
No, all good here. I'm ready to get back to it. Thankfully, the weather improved here today.
It did, and I think we've just lost Ian, so we're not going to hear from him.
That's a timing for him to drop off.
All right, we'll catch you later. Bye. Only do
no
it
pressure, mate.
Day.
No pressure.
I only do it all day, every day.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's only your job.